At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Welcome back to Millennial Money. My name is Andre Jick, and I'm joined here today by the one and only engaged Graham Stephan.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, congrats.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah. Cool. That was awesome. Tell us the story. You went, I didn't even know that you, I didn't know
Yeah,
any
I didn't
of
tell
this.
Many people.
And then you went to LA.
Yeah.
You went to Santa Monica.
Santa Monica Pier.
And then you proposed.
Yeah, at the top of the Ferris wheel, by the way.
Wow. That was the first date.
That was the first, I recreated the first date, and then at the top of the Ferris wheel, I figured that was the perfect opportunity.
Wait, okay. But you knew you were going
to I knew it was going to be at that point on that day.
Yeah.
I knew.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah.
Do you think she knew? Yeah, did you think she knew?
She says she didn't. I'm like, I think 85% she was like kind of figuring something was going to happen, but she said no. I mean, so I believe her on that.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, that's cool. I like the ring a lot. The opal is really pretty.
It's different.
Yeah,
I didn't really want to go with like a traditional, and neither did she, like the big diamond or anything like that. It's just so overplayed. Everyone's got big diamonds. No one has opals, though.
That's nice.
So opal is her stone, diamond is yours.
Yes, correct.
That's cool. I like it.
Yeah, thanks.
Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Do you know when the wedding is?
No. I mean, probably it's going to be a ways off just because we're both busy.
So, Graham, are you going to be selling tickets to the wedding or?
That'd be really funny to sell tickets to it. here's the thing. It's like, part of me, I couldn't profit from a wedding.
Right.
So it's not like I could sell tickets and be like, oh, guys, guess how much I just made. You couldn't do that. So it's either I'd have to spend the money back in the wedding, which I would absolutely do. But then it's like, well, why don't you just pay for it and not have to do that?
Right.
So then I thought, well, the only option would have to be you do it for charity. And then at least if you're buying a ticket, you're really donating that money to a charity. That's the only way. But, you know, probably not selling tickets. Maybe. I never want to say no.
Could you imagine in the middle of your vows, you're like, this next part is brought to you by FTX, our sponsor.
I wouldn't be opposed to that because that would because then you put all of that towards the wedding itself,
right?
And you could splurge in such a way that like I would have trouble spending money,
right?
Myself, but if someone like FTX US sponsors it, then I could be like, guys, you know, this all brought to you by FTX US.
I want you to pull your phones out and download the app.
There's a QR code underneath your seat. You're going to pull that out. One of you guys is going to be getting a full Bitcoin.
That'd
so
be cool.
That would be amazing.
That would be awesome. God. I like
half
that.
A Bitcoin or something.
I like that,
that
idea.
Wow.
Sam, let's make it happen.
When you deposit $2,000 on the platform, just everyone's waiting for the money to transfer.
Oh, that'd be great.
That would be hilarious. So anyway,
now
I
need to have
open.
It at a stadium, like you know, where the Knights play or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that'd be
like
epic.
An actual stadium.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
It sounds like a bad idea, but I think it'd be a great idea.
Bad idea. It's a Graham idea.
It's a Graham idea.
It's a great idea.
I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Yeah.
Just put a logo on the cake. I'd be why not?
Just on the side.
Yeah.
Sponsored
public.com. / Graham.
Graham, yeah. That's funny.
Just have it be the whole thing logo.
So speaking of crypto, what's going on? It's coming back.
The comeback is on, baby.
Barely. I mean, what? It stayed at 20, it dropped to 17, now it's back at 20.
Yeah, but it still did something historic that people thought was not even possible, dropping below its previous all-time high.
But here's the thing, though. For previous dips below that level,
yeah,
is there now? There's going to be a thing where it's like, if it stays above 20, that still holds true because it didn't sustain for more than a week. Mm. Like, there's going to be some variation of like it has to sustain it for more than X amount of time or drop X amount below. There's going to be something.
Yeah. No, no one ever thought that it could drop below its previous all-time high. So, do you guys remember the stock to flow model?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, it's supposed to kind of like now invalidate it because the range for the price of Bitcoin of where it should be now, which I think now it's supposed to be like at $110,000.
Whoa.
And now it's at, well, it was at $17,000. But now everyone's saying like, oh, stock to flow model's broken. And I don't think it's broken.
But
I
it is at 20.
It is at 20, but I will say it's not broken in the sense that the stock to flow model was never meant to predict macroeconomic factors. Like, no one could have known there was going to be a major conflict in Europe, crazy recession, crazy interest rate increases. Like, no one knew that was going to happen. So I mean, people obviously knew, but they expected it, but I'm just saying the stock to flow model has no way of predicting that. So to it's me, like, it's still not broken.
It's like analyst estimates in the stock market, you know, they'll be like, oh, the stock's going to 50 over the next 12 months, and then it's at like 10. It's like, wait, what happened here?
Right.
But the difference is, I don't know how the stock to flow model works, but analysts, they start bringing numbers down. So like, we're going down to a $30 price target, and they like adjust. And I guess the stock to flow model can do that, or it can't like change. It can't even change.
No, all it's doing is it's just looking at finite resources like commodities, like gold and silver. And a guy by the name of Plan B just applied it retroactively to Bitcoin.
Okay.
And all it's doing is just comparing the stock, which is like the amount of something in existence, to the flow, which is like the rate of creation of it. And then based on that, they're extrapolating into the future based on demand and what, you know, how much people are buying now into the future based on the quantity, because we can predict how many Bitcoins will be, you know, in a year and 2 years and whatever. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here in, there's so many subjects we can dive down here in regards to this that I have questions about, like, you know, the miners and if they're still able to be profitable and things like that. But just hearing Bitcoin and stock in the same sentence reminds me of, I don't know if you guys have ever gone on Google Trends and typed in Bitcoin, and one of the top Google trends in relation to Bitcoin is Bitcoin stock price.
Yes, and I'm remember that.
People really think Bitcoin's
is a stock. Yeah, like,
Bitcoin
stock price. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Like, come on, people, come on.
I've
man.
Seen
like literally,
that.
It's like the
that's
third,
funny.
Fourth most searched term next to Bitcoin.
Oh, no, that's true.
Gosh. But yeah, miners, are they still able to be profitable? Let's say at 20K?
Well, miners are too young to invest, so they have to be at least 18.
What? What? I'm talking about miners, like people that mine Bitcoin.
Oh, no, I was just playing with you, Jeremy.
your face was so serious. I know. Was like, wait, is he being actual serious?
Nah, I was messing with you.
Your face was super serious.
I had
like,
to be.
No.
Otherwise, they're going to give it away.
Well played. That's well cute. Played. Oh, gosh. In all seriousness, can you still mine Bitcoin profitably or not really?
I don't mind. I couldn't speak on it.
Okay.
But
I don't know, because energy costs are so high right now.
That's what I'm thinking.
I would imagine that they would scale back to a point where it would have to be profitable.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting because the mining aspect of Bitcoin is what's putting selling pressure. Because think about it. If you're a miner and you're spending all this money towards energy, part of the way to offset the cost is to sell Bitcoin off, which works great when Bitcoin's valuable and it's at 60K. Mm-hmm. When it drops to 17, you have to sell much more.
Yeah,
so it's like kind of a vicious cycle that keeps feeding into itself. Yep. As the price drops lower, you have to sell more to make your money back.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, I've been watching the Bitcoin price movements like a hawk, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. every night. And when I've seen these big movements down, dude, it is like straight down.
I've seen that video. Yeah, it's like a cliff.
Yes, like literally a cliff. And so it almost looks like that's big money potentially selling out. You know, like I don't want to say it's like a big investor, but it could be like a Celsius situation or somebody that's forced to liquidate because it's so unnatural.
Call.
Yeah, it's so unnatural, the movement and how it just goes down a straight line. It's not like a slow, steady kind of boop, boop, boop.
Right.
And so I don't know. And then I'm hearing conspiracy theory. I don't know if it's true or conspiracy theories or whatever, but there's what I'm hearing is there's like a war inside Bitcoin going on right now between some of the different brokerages and some of the different whales in Bitcoin, where somebody didn't scratch somebody else's back and therefore it's retaliation. And it all goes back to this Luna situation, the Celsius situation. I don't want to dive too much. If people really want to go down that rabbit hole, go down your own rabbit hole there.
I didn't hear this story.
Yeah, it's, okay. If you really dive in there, man, it's a whole
some
bunch.
Of it, I think, is so just out there. Remember the one with Citadel? Like, Citadel borrowed money and then shorted this. And, like, I bet they probably have better things to do than
right.
influencing the price of some of these coins. I mean,
no, I imagine the same. But yeah. I will say one of my concerns was, did you see the Michael Saylor's position?
Yeah, what about what?
So he owns how many Bitcoins was it?
Owns like 130,000.
130,000 Bitcoins, that's right, at a price average of $30,700.
Yes.
So he's down like $1.25 billion. And people are worried that once Bitcoin goes down to a certain price, he can get liquidated, right?
Yeah. And that whole situation is very confusing and doesn't make sense to me, because what I've heard is they claim that Bitcoin would have to go to $3,500 for them to have to put up more collateral. But I'm like, how is that even possible? Because if their average cost is, let's say, $30,000, how are they able to go down 90% before they start to get any sort of put up collateral? So I don't know. It just seems like a weird situation.
So from my understanding, his blended interest rate for what he borrowed. So he took out a loan for $2.2 billion, basically. Mm-hmm. $1.7 billion of that was non-collateralized.
Okay.
The other $500 million is owed 7 years after he took the loan out.
Okay.
So I guess 7 years from this year, or maybe last year. I guess he's been taking it out over a period of time. Mm-hmm. So in 7 years, that money will come due, $500 million. Wow. The good thing is the interest rate is really low. It's 1.8% on average, which is really, really low. And considering MicroStrategy has a cash flow, mm-hmm. hopefully he can pay that back in 7 years, and hopefully Bitcoin will be worth more. So
it's so risky.
It is super risky.
Borrow and leverage on Bitcoin? Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And I think part of that, the market knows that, and I think that's part of the reason why it's so volatile, because it's like, are all these whales going to get liquidated that have these crazy positions? Because he's not the only one.
Yep. So, playing MicroStrategy, that's almost like playing, it reminds me of playing like a 2X or 3X leverage ETF on Bitcoin price, essentially, where if Bitcoin goes down 5%, you'd probably expect MicroStrategy to go down 10, 15.
Right.
On the flip side, if Bitcoin goes up 5%, you expect, a 2X, 3X there. But yeah, that is it's a very risky strategy. He's going
to be. It's a micro strategy.
It's a micro strategy.
I don't know what that means, but it's funny.
It's a micro strategy. Yeah. Well, that's Bitcoin.
So, Ethereum. What's going on with Ethereum? Do we like Ethereum? Do we not like Ethereum? Where's the tie going?
Ethereum right now.
Oh, Alex, he's Ethereum.
Back. Now, Jeremy, I've never seen you take this much interest in crypto. It's unusual. It's odd for me to hear this coming from you. We usually hear this coming from the other side of the room. What prompted this, Jeremy? Because it was like 6 months ago. I would tell you to. I remember. I had to just buy a Bitcoin, buy any Ethereum, just buy something.
Yeah.
What happened?
It's very interesting now. The drama's here, and so I love crashing assets. If you know me, I look for the crash, man. And Ethereum and Bitcoin are the crash. So
Jerry's like, I like to catch falling knives.
Where's that?
Now it would be funny if your wife was doing the opposite of whatever you're doing. She just did the inverse portfolio, and so actually, like, you haven't lost any money.
Oh wow!
Because she did the inverse of it.
Yeah, right?
I like that strategy. Now
shorted Bitcoin,
shorting everything he does.
Hey, before we get on to that, how much are you down on Bitcoin, Graham? And how much are you down on Ethereum?
Oh, not actually. Oh, no, because my cost basis on Bitcoin is probably 28, 29, 30, 31, somewhere around there.
Okay.
So what's that, a 30% loss overall on that? Ethereum, I don't know what the cost basis is. What, 15 to 1800 probably on Ethereum?
Jeremy's like...
So, you know what?
How many millions is that?
I'm probably down 35%, I'd guess, overall. Mm. But I have been buying Bitcoin. I do buy Bitcoin and Ethereum still consistently.
When was the first time you bought Bitcoin? What price was it at?
Very, very, very first was like 15, 16.
Wow, okay. So that's how your cost base is fairly.
No, that was back in 2017.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I basically gambled it away on altcoins. Oh, it went
that's
bad.
Fun.
Yeah. I made a whole bunch of money on Ryblox back then.
Oh, I thought it was a
genius.
That
remember
one.
That? Oh, yeah. From gosh. Like $2 to $40-something. That is a genius.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Dang.
And now it's just like down. But actually, I think it's about the same price as where I forgot. I've just kept it all since then.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm down. I'm definitely down. But I have been just dollar cost averaging. And I just do that on almost a regular basis.
Yeah, interesting.
Fun fact. Sorry.
Yep.
Jeremy, people have not lost money if they held Bitcoin for more than 4 years.
Oh, yeah, but you know what? They'll say that until, it broke the rule.
True.
First
but
time
so
ever.
Far it hasn't been broken.
That's, so far it's never dropped below the previous all-time high.
And to that point, Andre, something, an interesting study I found recently is basically 20K is such an important level because at 20K, basically half of Bitcoin is above where it was bought and half is below. So if Bitcoin goes obviously substantially below 20, the more people that are now down on Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So that's just kind of interesting. But the
average four-year moving the four-year moving average price on Bitcoin is $21,685.
Oh.
So we are now trading at this rare period of time where Bitcoin hasn't really existed too long in.
Yeah.
So you know, if people are thinking about, you know, maybe putting something into crypto or Bitcoin specifically, then now would be the time to do it as long as it's under that 21,000 mark.
Okay.
And how much of someone's portfolio would you say is reasonable to invest in something like this?
That's such a hard question because I don't know. I think it depends on the person's situation. Okay. For me, it's I want to say like 25-30% at least.
Okay.
At least?
Yeah.
And that's just Bitcoin or crypto in general?
Bitcoin specifically.
Bitcoin specifically.
Seems like a lot, 25%. I'd be just under 10. I think right now I'm about 4-5%.
Yeah.
At the peak, it was 7-8. I think now it's 4-5.
I want to say I invested like 10%, and then it jumped up to like 50% of my net worth.
Oh,
at the peak.
Yeah, at the peak.
Now it's back down, obviously. But I would say my average cost basis would probably be around 25.
Okay.
25K, yeah.
That's not bad.
It's not too bad.
No, I mean, that's way better than most people.
Still, considering how long I've been in it, for me to be down, I can imagine how scared people must feel if they've never been through this.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of the retail that got attracted, it was like 30K, 40K, 50K, 60K. So, you know, if you got in it at any point in the past 1 to 2 years, essentially, you're likely at least 20 plus, but you're likely in the 30s, 40s, 50s.
Did you see those memes that are like Bitcoin at 60K and there's like a huge line and people are like, oh, I wish I had bought earlier. And then Bitcoin's at 17 and like, oh, Bitcoin's a scam.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
Or yeah, Bitcoin's dead. It's like when it's down, Bitcoin's dead. And then when it's up, Bitcoin's a bubble. Bitcoin's dead. Bitcoin's a bubble.
Yeah.
Well, listen, one of the great ways that you could do that is all thanks to our sponsor, FTX US, down below in the description with the code MMFTX. They're one of the largest US regulated crypto exchanges in the world with millions of users who trust them to buy, sell, track, and trade both crypto and NFTs all in one place with fees that are much lower than the competition. They have no ACH fees, no withdrawal fees, and no fees on the top Ethereum and Solana collections for NFTs.
And I bought some Bitcoin on FTX US the other night and I got a free coin with it.
Because
every
coin?
Trade, I bought some Bitcoin actually.
Did you actually?
Yeah,
what was the free coin you got?
I think it was Dogecoin.
Jeremy bought $11 of Bitcoin just to get the free Dogecoin. $10.01 and just get
it. I thought of that because I'm like, why not just buy like a smaller amount each time so you keep collecting the free coins?
Technically, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't do that.
Because I bought $500 and I'm like, I should get more free coins.
I thought the same thing.
Okay.
Honestly,
how many
I know we're going way off.
Make?
But like you should be setting this up. It's too bad because they allow for automatic deposits.
Buys.
Yeah, recurring buys. Yeah. So basically you could dollar cost average into the markets on a regular basis, which is what we're doing. But it would be nice if they could just set it so that you buy $10.01 every like 5 minutes or every minute over the course of like however much you want to invest. So that way you continually just I don't know what that would equate to. It's probably not worth the time, like 1% back.
That's what
like,
I was thinking. I was thinking about my time spent on that.
At that point you're better off just using their crypto friendly debit card that's, you know, you could use at millions of merchants worldwide.
That is very true.
Wow,
Alex.
Alex.
What do you have to say about it, Andre?
You know what? I agree with everything you guys said. It's great. 100%. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah, and that is the first link in the description down there.
Yes,
so.
And they support the channel. So, thank you so much again to FTX US.
Or you could take out leverage like Alex.
Oh,
guys, I close that out. That's, you know, slap on the wrist.
So, again, the link is down below in the description. And big thank you to FTX US for making these podcasts possible.
Yes.
Ooh, quick question for you, Jeremy.
Yes, sir.
So, you know how the average price drop in a bear market in stocks is like 34%?
Yeah.
So I'm seeing a lot of articles now talk about this dreaded 45-50% drop, which happened in the 70s, right?
Yep.
Where, okay, so backstory, interest rates went up to like 11% in 1974. And by 1975, the stock market had pretty much plummeted 45%.
Yeah.
So do you think that's possible now?
It's always possible, absolutely. I mean,
do you see that happening?
The stock market, everything's on the table. I think that only happens if we go through a massive recession.
Okay.
We need a massive recession to get that sort of price movement down. Going into today, the NASDAQ was down about 33% roughly off all-time highs. The S&P 500 and the Dow have lagged big time. So the Dow going into today was only down 19.2%. S&P 500 only down 23.5%. Mm-hmm. Usually those are within 5 percentage points of the NASDAQ. So what's interesting is the Dow and the S&P have to catch up. Those have held up a little better because oil and gas stocks. I feel like I'm losing you guys. I'm not losing
you're,
you, right?
You're talking really fast.
I'm hearing it, but tech valuation. That's so high.
You're saying tech is leading the way.
Yes, with the NASDAQ. Yes, 100%.
Yes.
Yeah, and oil and gas stocks and some of those have held up really well, right. done really well. So it's made the S&P 500 and the Dow 30 look better, I guess you can say. But at the flip side, if we're going to go into a big recession, likely oil is coming down.
How does the Russell 2000 integrate into that?
The Russell 2000 a lot of times can lead you there as well because people usually don't want to hold small caps in a situation that you're going into recession. Now, those can come back the fastest as you climb out. But it was interesting. The other day, I looked at the Russell 2000. In the past 5 years, the Russell's only up 17%.
In the five years. Oh, wow.
Which is just awful performance. Like, just horrible.
What should it be at?
I mean, the other indexes were at like 30 to 50% over the past 5 years. So just the Russell's been just an awful place for a while now. But yeah, if we're going to have that type of like halving of the stock market of the S&P, you need a real like massive recession. Like, it has to be confirmed. The job losses have to be big. And you likely have to get an event to happen that gets everybody into panic. So in 2020, we had that event. It was a once in a hundred year health event, right? That caused mass panic.
Once in a lifetime millennial event.
Yeah, the VIX goes to 50 plus. In the great financial crisis, we had that event, which was like AIG, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all those going under. And so you have to have a shock and awe event happen in order to get that just complete capitulation where everybody loses their mind. Sell, sell, sell. Outside of that, it's really hard to get like an S&P to go down like 50%. Yeah. It's not something that usually happens. So, but I mean, when I look out there, it's really going to depend on many various factors. We need oil to come down. The more oil stays up, I think the more likely we could have a big recession because that's just taking people's money left and right now. You know, these gas prices at $5, $6, $7 a gallon is horrible. Yeah.
LA
horrible.
Was $7.
Oh, seven. Jesus.
$7. Some we saw almost as high as $8.
Oh,
and that's $8 for a gallon.
For the basic?
Yeah, so the basics were about $7.09, and then they went all the way up to like $7.50. Wow. But some of the areas, like if you go around Beverly Hills, West Hollywood, it's like $7.99, $7.89. Jeez. It's like $8 a gallon.
Yes.
I've always been curious how like gas stations that are relatively close to each other have such huge disparities in price.
It's because flow of traffic. So sometimes if people want the convenience, it's difficult to flip around sometimes in, you know, rush hour traffic. No, seriously.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
So if you're on one side and you could enter on that side and exit that side and go right. in the same direction.
Oh, okay.
Is that worth the premium? I bet to a lot of people it is.
That's LA logic. Yeah. I've never
because you can't
that
flip around.
Sense, yeah.
If you're in traffic, you have to make a turn, which is waiting a few minutes, and then you have to drive down and find another turn, wait a few minutes for that light, and it takes a few minutes.
That's crazy.
Los Angeles. Not as always easy as
Do you have a specific gas station that you either go to or you avoid? Because for me, it's like Shell. I just avoid Shell.
I haven't been to a gas station forever. I drive the Tesla.
That's funny.
Oh, you do? You drive the Tesla.
And here, the car, I fill it up every few months.
Okay.
Like the Ford, I filled it up maybe 3 months ago, and this Volvo is going on like 4 months.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm waiting for gas prices to come down and I can fill it up again. Because I filled it up before the crazy gas prices, both of the cars. So I was paying like $4 a gallon.
I actually just filled up the Toyota that I pulled up in. 2017 Toyota Corolla, yeah. $60.
Wow.
For 10 gallons.
Dude. Wow.
That's
for
nuts.
For the Toyota?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, if you're working minimum wage, how do the middle class do it, Jeremy?
Oh, gosh, the middle class.
Tell us about the middle class, Jeremy. No,
the middle class is getting devastated.
But no, seriously, like if you're in California making $10 an hour, $12 an hour, and you're commuting 30 minutes to work.
That's your guess.
That eats up such a big part of your income that day.
Well, I think, well, I think
$10 an hour is not middle class.
Yeah.
I think that's below
middle class. No, I was just saying as an example. I was making a joke for Jeremy.
No, even 60K, 70K, it like, oh my gosh, it just steals so much money.
Jeremy's like, how do you survive on $120,000 a year? Like,
with a family of four in Los Angeles.
Yeah. No, seriously, that's just crazy.
I mean, in Los Angeles, crazy. That's a different story.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, even 120 with a family is like, geez.
How do you do it? $10,000 a month. $300 a day for a family of four.
Graham's
really?
Been feeling the heat with gas prices. He calls me up. He's like, hey, can you take me to Costco?
Yo, you going to Costco? Just let me know. I'll hit your ride. No, can you draw me up here really quick?
I have to ask, is that actually for real?
No, no, but okay. Crazy. It sounded like it could be for real. Yeah.
The
not?
Fact that you questioned that, Andre, like even thought on. That would be even real. No.
Can you leave one of the kids at home and leave me a spot in the car?
Sounds plausible,
a spot in the car.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Macy will keep an eye on Enzo. Just take me in the back. Yeah, I'll be with the baby.
What, the real scenario, I'd ask Jeremy, hey, could you pick up some salmon when you're at Costco? And I'll reimburse you. Just let me know how much it is.
Salmon? We're in a recession. No. You better say chicken.
Yeah.
No salmon in the recession.
Salmon's eating good. Too much, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Sam's Club. Talk about real estate. What's going on there?
Gosh. Oh. Real estate.
Got to give us your house update, Jeremy. Every
nothing.
Week,
there's nothing. No to update. Showings. No one. No.
No showings.
So, no.
What are you doing?
Gonna probably take it off market eventually and just rent it out. Jeez. So
you gotta have a plan.
Yeah. Like,
so
yeah,
what's the plan?
Is
take it off market.
Yeah, likely. Gonna wait a bit more here. I don't want to say the exact.
Well, you
date,
gotta reduce
but
the price.
Already did.
To what?
An undisclosed number, but it was your number.
How much did you? Yeah, it was no, your number. What's the dollar amount? Just share the dollar amount that you reduced it to.
No, I still don't want
to. No,
but
you could
that.
Be like, I reduced it $75,000. Or
I reduced it a number. It's just
do you know the percent.
Yeah, but I still don't even want to share that number.
Oh, okay.
The issue though with that is that you've already lost the momentum.
There's
so,
no
like,
momentum out
I
there
know,
right
but,
now.
I know, but when you price
yeah
high or when you price at a higher number. All the activity comes in the first 7 days. Mm-hmm. And so in this market, if you don't have either a lot of showings or an offer in 7 days, maybe 10, maybe 14, then you miss that initial wave. So what you should do, and this is a trick, is a lot of agents have done this.
Mm-hmm.
You cancel the listing and then you sign a new listing agreement because you can't on the MLS just cancel listing, put it back up so it's new again. But you can cancel the listing and then list it again a week later. You should be doing that. So if it, you should have consulted with me here, Jeremy.
Okay.
Because I would have told you not to reduce the price.
Yeah.
And then remove the listing off the market, wait a week, put it back on, and have a new image as the front, like front image. So that way people see it, they're like, oh wow, this is a new listing, and they'll take a look at it again from the perspective of, oh, this is a lot more affordable.
Yeah.
Mm. It's not too late. You could do it. But when they look back at the history and they see that you've already reduced the price, the issue that sets is, well, it was listed at that price before, and now it's listed at the same price. Is it really any better? That's the issue. But what you could also do is another trick, raise the price right now. So raise the price back to the initial price, then take it off the market, then sign a new listing agreement and put it back on. So only agents who look at the price history are going to see that, but a lot of other people, it just shows up at the latest price it was taken off the market.
Interesting.
Well, how's the rental market looking like? Do you guys think that's going down, or you're not thinking that?
I don't keep track of it enough to really.
Because the reason I ask is because I just got a rental management company to help me out with mine. So we'll see.
Okay, yeah. And Graham, how do you feel about rental management companies? Because I'm curious. Yeah,
what's a good rate to
big fan so far. So I rented a property in LA that I should have gotten $5,600 a month for, maybe $5,700, and I put it on the market and it was slow. And I got showings, but just no offers. And I reduced the price after about 7 to 10 days, and then I got an offer at $5,000. And to me, that was really low, but it was easier. It's better to take $5,000. And I was talking with the management company, because I don't pay attention to that segment in LA. But they were saying that in the price point above like $4,500 to $5,000 a month, a lot of those people who would be renting are choosing instead to move to other states. And that was the issue. The last person I had in there moved from that area to Texas.
Right. Mm.
And I have another vacancy coming up. They've only been there for 2 years, but they're moving from, again, California to, I think it's also Texas.
Mm.
Have you ever managed a property yourself, or have you always used a company?
No, this is new for me to use a company. Oh, I've done everything myself until the first manager I got like 3 years ago on a property during a vacancy.
What made you take the leap?
Time. I wasn't there to show it. There were a whole bunch of little minor repairs. I didn't want to deal with it. Best decision ever. I really enjoyed it. I mean, there's still work on my end because they'll send me the tenant and then I do my own investigation on the tenant. Like, right. I don't take them at just, even if they say this is a good tenant, we recommend them, I'll still like do some digging and try to like see what I could what I could find. Yeah. There's been a few times where I found like the numbers that they've listed are not actually the landlord's. So that's a big one. So what I do, anytime they give a phone number, I'll Google the phone number with quotes and it shows you the exact result for that number. Sometimes they'll say, oh, this is our property manager. Google the number, it's not. It turns out to be like a friend of theirs. And when you dig into the real property manager, you'll find the real number. So people will sometimes lie on their applications. So I investigate everything.
What happened? Wait, the tenant does that?
Yeah.
So
let's say the tenant is not having a good relationship with their landlord. Okay. And they don't want the landlord to know that they're moving, or let's just say that they're behind on their rent, or the landlord would have something bad to say about them. They'll, instead of giving them as a reference, give the real name, but just give the number to a buddy.
Got it.
Hey, if you get a call, just say, you're John. Mm-hmm. And they'll pick up. Yep, I'm John. And they'll fake it. So I've caught that so many times.
You've caught that so many times?
Oh, yeah.
Jeez.
It's common.
People are clever.
I don't think exactly. I think it's the lowest hanging fruit.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, there's been one. This is a while ago where I found the real. Oh, you know what it was? They listed something as like a previous residence. And the number that they listed was like going to some person that was not listed on as the owner. And so what I did is I looked at the address and I saw it had been previously listed. And so I called the listing agent at the time. I say, hey, I know it's super weird, but is there any chance you could give me your client's information? I saw you represented this property back then and someone's claiming to live there. It really helped me out a lot. And usually they're all really friendly and been like, sure, you know, I'll pass your information along. Got me the info. I called them up and they say, no, they were terrible tenants. We had to evict them. They refused to leave. I mean, just a whole bunch of stuff. So, wow.
So yeah. Any pro tips for me as I get qualified tenants?
Trust but verify is like the go-to thing. You can trust them, but just make sure, you know.
Yeah. Would you recommend calling the references?
Usually the manager will do it, but I verify that like that's real information.
Why does Andre have to do this? Shouldn't the management company do all this for him?
Yeah, but if you...
What's the point of having a management company?
They're never going to do it to the level that I would at least be satisfied.
Mm.
So I'm always extra cautious just because, you know, when you're going through dozens of applications a week, it inevitably something will slip through the cracks. And I don't want that to be on me.
Oh, okay. Do you think that so here's the deal that the property management company that I'm going with gave me. So they said 8% of the total month's rent, and the first month's rent is 50% of the monthly payment.
Standard. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's standard. I pay 8% plus. Yeah, I mean, it sounds about right.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes like you could negotiate down like 7%. I mean, you could always negotiate, but I found that like I'd rather them just do a good job.
Right.
And so it's not worth negotiating.
Right.
That's reasonable to me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
And a good job is making sure you actually handle everything and making sure you verify everything.
No, but I've already taken all the pictures because I know I've seen their photograph. Like,
Horrible.
They're horrible. Yes. Just the whole industry is so bad.
Wait a second. The manager is not using professional photography?
No one does that.
No one.
What?
No one.
LA, what? It's standard.
No, not here.
I paid like $250 for a professional photographer that the management company strongly recommended.
Right.
In order to rent out the place.
I went out of my way to spend hours getting these photos because the house isn't like perfectly set up like in the pictures. Mm-hmm. So I went out of my way to like Photoshop, like fix things that I know could be fixed with.
You
like
took the photos yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
With like a pro camera, like, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So it looks good. So I told them specifically, I was like,
so you photoshopped out all the defects, like all the,
not the defects,
stains,
the marks, the nails and stuff that I know are going to get repaired, you know,
for sure.
But,
the water damage,
the water damage.
I'm joking.
Yeah.
The foundation cracks.
Great, Graham. You lost me a tenant.
The rodents.
The rodents. Just the roaches. No, but yeah, seriously. Yeah, that's funny. It's, okay. And I asked them to give me a discount. I was like, could you guys give me a discount considering I've already done all the photos? And they're like, no, unfortunately, we still have to pay the fees and all the stuff. But
I should have asked that ahead of time before you took the pictures. I did. Before you took the pictures?
Not before I took the pictures.
I
asked afterwards, before I signed with them. I said, hey, before I sign, would you guys possibly consider giving a small discount? And they said, no, unfortunately not. So,
okay.
Get another quote. Yeah, well, it's too late now, but ideally...
No, I haven't signed it yet.
You haven't signed it yet. Get another quote. So with me in LA, I spoke with three people, and I went with the guy who picked up on like almost immediately.
Okay.
And leaves his cell phone there. Because I knew that like with you, Jeremy, if they pick up the phone and they're available, that's the person I want.
Right.
The other guys, I would leave messages and they'd get back to me like later that day. I was like leaving a voicemail. How many people do you lose as a tenant? So
specifically, what time did you call them?
Probably that was late morning, early afternoon. I mean, it was
during business
hours. I mean, I could excuse it if I'm calling at like 10 p.m. or 9 or 8. I get it, but
That's worth trying. So maybe I'll give them a call and see if they pick up.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's the crazy thing. The house that I rented for $5,000 a month, here's how just crazy valuations are for rents. That property's probably worth right now on the low end 1.2, high end 1.3.
Wow.
For what?
$5,000 a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, rents have gone so crazy, especially in the neighborhood that I'm in. There's nothing for rent. Nothing for rent there.
If you get that price.
Yeah.
So be it, but maybe because I don't look at the rental market here. I'm very much like Los Angeles,
right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe,
yeah,
yeah. If you get it, you know, more power to you.
Yeah.
At Parker, our purpose is simple: we want to make the world a better place by working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies. We keep moving forward with each new idea, innovation, and partnership. We're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking about rents, everybody's being squeezed by rents. That's also destroying the middle class because how many people have to rent, man?
Yeah.
There isn't enough things. All these greedy landlords keep raising their rents.
I don't know. I've never been against renting as much as people on average in the U.S. have always been like, you should never rent. It's wasting money. Yeah. I've never thought that.
I think, man, it's. You know, I think it was John Oliver did a whole piece on rent recently.
Yeah,
and I've always felt conflicted about renting, right? Because it's like, it is a need in the marketplace.
Did you see the Dave Ramsey thing?
Yes.
Like, yeah, I'm a good plugged Christian, him in there.
But yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he showed a video clip of this one guy and he's like, I don't care if, you know, they got cancer or whatever.
Oh.
You know, if they're not paying, they're out, you know, and just stuff like that. Yeah, and just like the whole, it's a tricky situation because a lot of people feel like housing is a human right? But at the end of the day, like, you're there to still run a business, and it's just a...
Why don't they do that with food?
What's that?
Food. Food is I feel like food is just as essential as housing, if not more.
That's true.
So why don't people protest grocery store prices? Really?
It's a good point. I think the way it looks, I guess you can say, is like, you're kicking my family out. You know, you're kicking us out on the street. I think it's the optics of the way it looks in the context. And it doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It's just the way it's perceived or it looks. And it's like this greedy landlord, you know, they're kicking us out.
You know, I feel it's a shame that just the system in general is so flawed, and they place the blame and the responsibility on landlords.
Yeah.
Instead of fixing the actual issue of the fact that we need more housing. Now, the building permits are so expensive.
Besides fixing the supply, is there anything else that could be done in theory?
I think rent control is just a band-aid over the situation. It forces landlords to raise rents because otherwise they lose the opportunity if they don't do it. So they have to.
Right.
I think if we...
Is there any reasonable solution besides rent control or like supply increasing that could solve the problem? For example, not allowing institutional hedge funds to buy, you know, real estate.
No, I feel like there's always going to be a way around that. And in a way, institutional buyers, if they, at the end of the day, if they're renting out property and they're not just holding it empty, then they're also adding supply in a way to the market.
But they're also, you know, increasing their prices.
But it's not just anyone could raise prices on that. You don't have, and you could be a terrible landlord being a private person versus an institutional.
Yeah, but the
landlord.
Amount of money that those companies have versus a private buyer would be a lot less. So the argument here is that the institutional buyers are heating up the market so much because they're competing with money.
My point is
that
all of these are just temporary solution fixes to say, oh, look, we did something.
Right.
But it's like, you know, if you have a headache and you just take more Advil.
Yeah.
Keep taking more Advil. I drink more water. But what if you have a brain tumor?
No, that's fair. I follow.
So
I don't have a position.
But... Yeah. I think the solution has to be you need more housing units. That's the only thing that's really going to bring down costs. And to do that, you have to loosen some of the regulation and make it easier and more accessible for people to build.
Right.
The process is so stringent, let's say in Los Angeles, if you want to build another unit on the property, well, guess what? If you have a single family property and you want to build a guest house, well, now the property is considered a duplex and that is now subject to rent control, whereas before it was not. And so you're limited to what you could do because of that policy that's in place, not to mention how expensive it is and how lengthy the process is to build a guest house if you want to. So I think if they just... made it an easier product, I think it would benefit so many people. Like not only would homeowners have the option to turn their backyard, a lot of unused space, into a potential way to generate income.
Yeah.
But it would also add to the supply. You just need more supply.
I imagine the real answer is probably somewhere in between where it's like, it's that, but it's also maybe a couple other things.
Yeah.
Too. Maybe rent control is not one of them. And I don't have enough research to justify having a strong position on this, but it seems to make sense that if you don't allow, billion-dollar companies to buy.
That's where it gets complicated.
Now, Vegas actually has an interesting approach with this, is that if you have a primary residence, you can only have one, then your property tax increases are capped at 3%, versus if it's just a second property or a rental, they could increase your property taxes up to a certain amount, 8 to 10% every year. Mm. So, I mean, that could be an option. And then, but also depends, where's that money going? Is it going to line the pockets of people wasting it? Then I think it's terrible.
Yeah.
But if that money goes directly to making the process easier, hiring more people
to
go out and inspect these properties and expedite the process, waiting for someone
the issue is
look at jobs.
The big company or big fund or whatever, they raised $250 million, right? So now they got to go invest that in the market. Now, John and Carol got to compete against this big fund for that house. They get outbid because the fund has way more money. So they buy that house, right? Now, John and Carol can't buy that house. Now, simultaneously, you have this massive buyer buying up all these homes. It makes prices go up, right? Which is great if you already own a home, but for the new couple trying to buy a home, now those folks have to rent. Now, on top of that, if all the supply is being taken out of the market, rents are going to keep going up. So John and Carol keep getting squeezed simply because of a somewhat broken system around these folks being able to get money for so cheap.
Right.
You know what? I mean,
when
you look at the data.
Hold on, not to mention, though, real estate globally is extremely expensive in relation to the U.S. What is our average income to purchase ratios? On average, is five, I think. Mm-hmm. Nine in L.A. or California, three in the middle, in the Midwest or something. But on the most part, in relation to other parts of the world, I think in China, it's excess of 30 plus
some cities.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, imagine the amount of money that's also coming in from international, international money that's coming into the U.S.
Yeah.
Because we're cheap still.
Yeah.
So is that maybe part of the solution where it's you don't allow, foreign money to enter
the market?
Well,
that's what Canada did. But in relation to your point, when you at least look at the numbers, mm-hmm. and I know everyone has their own anecdotal story and say, oh, I've been on this house, or I was listing this house, and my experience was different. But when you look at the actual numbers on this, and again, who knows, everyone's going to have something different to say. Right. They make up such a small percentage of the market. I mean, it's like under 1%.
So if they make up such a small percentage of the market, then it wouldn't matter placing restrictions on these big institutional buyers because there's so little in the market.
Yeah,
so
I don't know about that. I mean, you know, Revensure Consulting, that channel, guy goes really in depth, and he was showing some areas of like Atlanta where like 30% of the buyers are big money, like institutional type buying in some of those markets. So I think it depends on a state by state basis.
Some of that is skewed data. He mentioned today, because I watched his videos as well, that only 84% of tenants pay their rent this month, and or something, whereas the norm is like 94%. But he's citing a study that I mentioned 2 years ago that like that's normal. It's only like 70% of tenants pay their rent in full within the first 5 days. Mm. And he cited that as landlords are not getting their rent without showing the full picture of like, that's normal. And the 94% is paid in full by the end of that month. Mm. So there's data that you have to explain every little piece of data for it to make sense. So on a small thing like that, you could go into 3 minutes explaining.
Yeah.
This is how the data is pulled and how they calculate it.
Yeah.
But that's not the full picture.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So do you think that in any way, shape or form kind of like relates to how the Fed gives like CPI data where it's like, is it really 8%?
Oh my gosh.
It's like, are the numbers, I don't know.
Yes. I mean, there's so many ways that they could manipulate those numbers to bring it down and make it artificially lower.
Right.
So, and that objectively, when you look at how they calculate it, there's a lot of things that they can't skew in their favor.
Right. That's fair. Like I knew you talked about it. The what was it? Rent.
Owner's equivalent rent.
Yeah.
That's not going to be an accurate guide.
Right.
But then again, it's also difficult to say because when you have a tenant who signed, let's say a 5-year lease, or let's say 2-year lease, okay? They're not going to see a rent increase during those 2 years. Even though, let's just say, market value of that rent maybe went up 30%. So do you calculate it based on market rate rent at that time? How do you balance the two? It becomes difficult. So owner's equivalent rent kind of makes sense, but it's also not the most reliable.
Right.
I don't know how you would balance it overall, to be honest with you. Because a lot of tenants are baked in. They could be rent controlled that skew that. So leasing a place today might be different.
Yeah. Well, also for CPI data, it never made, like the core CPI metric never made sense to me, where it's like, oh, we exclude food and gas prices. Like, thanks, I'm just not going to fill up my car
this month. The purpose of that was just excluding items that might be volatile.
Yeah, I know, but that it's like, volatility has nothing to do with like how I live my life.
But here's the thing, you don't want to include necessarily, you want to have a separate metric so that inflation isn't like, all right, this week inflation is 15%. Next week it's 7%. All right. The week after that, it's negative because gas prices went down. Oh, no, but like they want to separate the two just so that you could really isolate each point. And so that's the reason why. It makes sense to me.
No, it makes sense. It just also skews the numbers and, their favor.
That's why they offer both CPIs.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I tend to pay attention more to the CPI than the core CPI, but I know there's also the PCE, but that's a different story.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And then the problem with those, and I know we've talked about this before, is a lot of them are backwards looking and things can change, very, very quickly. So, real estate's in a tricky spot with these interest rates. Now we're over 6% on a 30-year, I believe now.
5.5 to 6.5, depending on your loan.
Yeah. Crazy. So, yeah. That's just.
Where do you guys think the federal fund rate will probably end up at the end of the year? 3.5%?
I'll make about 3.
3? 3.5?
Okay. Yeah, somewhere in there. That sounds pretty realistic.
What are we at right now? 1.75, I believe.
So at that point, prime rates should be 6.5, which means mortgages at that point would be somewhere between 6 to 7.
Yeah, it could be 7 by the end of the summer, in my opinion. But yeah, it's a messy that, and that can move on the 10-year too. But it's a messy situation because even as inflation starts to come down, because we're from such a high number, like the Fed's going to have to keep raising. So even when it drops to 7 and drops to 6 and drops to 5, it's still like insanely high. So likely the Fed's going to have to keep raising. It's just a question of like, is it 75 basis points? Is it 50 basis points? They tame it down to 25 basis points. We need oil to go down. We need commodities to go down. And almost hardly anybody pays attention to commodities. Wheat, corn, oats, those sorts of things. We need those to keep going down.
So you know how for the last decade we've been in an environment where we had like artificially low interest rates?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we've now entered maybe potentially the next decade where rates are just not going to be low?
Woo. I think only if we had a fairly strong economy throughout that time.
Okay.
I think if we got
really high inflation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think to have sustained really high inflation is going to think it's going to be difficult because you need things to keep going up. Like let's say 7%, 8%. Then next year you need that same 7, 8%. Then the next year you need another 7, 8%. I think that gets difficult. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you could end up in that wage, what do they call it? The wage price?
Waste price spiral.
Yeah, spiral. Yeah. So let's hope that doesn't happen.
You could end up in a spiral.
Yeah. Where it's just kind of
spiral
like,
thingy.
Yeah.
Spyro.
But you know, as soon as unemployment.
Alex got my reference.
Alex, you got it?
I love Spyro.
As soon as unemployment starts to go crazy, whenever that is, if that happens, you know they're going to start bringing down interest rates because that's when everybody starts caring about that. Right now, everybody's very focused on inflation.
Yeah.
Jobs are out there, at least they have been out there. Yeah. If the jobs go away, then everybody stops caring about inflation. Then everybody starts caring about jobs.
Yeah.
If everybody starts caring about jobs, then that's when the Fed.
Well,
you know,
did you see what Jerome Powell recently said? He literally said, I almost quote word for word, where he said, if you're a young person trying to buy a house right now, you need a bit of a reset. Just kind of a hard stance.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Need a bit of a reset.
Yeah.
Now, are we talking about the biggest wealth transfer in history?
Yeah. The great reset?
The great reset? Did yeah. Someone oh say the great reset?
It'd be funny if he's like, you need an inheritance.
You need an inheritance.
Well, I'll tell you guys, you know, as somebody who is in the middle class trying to buy a house, it's
upper
tough.
Middle class, Alex.
What?
Oh!
Upper.
According to, class. To what?
According to statistics? What's upper middle class?
Ooh, I don't know. It depends on the state, I suppose.
What's upper middle class? All right, all right.
Slightly upper middle class.
I always think upper middle class is 100K up income. That's my, yeah. In my
oh,
six
there you
figures,
go, Alan. Yeah.
You're making six figures this year?
Let's not talk about that. But as somebody who's buying a house, I find it.
Not after Ethereum what dumps.
Not after I get margin called. Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely not.
What do you see, Alex?
It's difficult. Like I'm doing the math. Obviously we're like stockpiling cash, but I'm looking at these housing prices and I'm like, I would love to find something cheaper than what I'm looking at, but I can't find any good houses.
What's the price range you're looking at right now?
The price range I'm looking at, the price range I want
one to
be
$2 million.
Well, let's do both. Let's do both. What price are you wanting to buy? Like maybe not you can afford, but what you want to buy?
I would love to buy somewhere in like the 400s,
okay.
But ideally to stick to like my budget and what I really feel comfortable in. Personally, I'd love to stay between like 250 and 350.
Right.
Yeah, probably not buying 250, 350. Here's the issue is that they're not building constructions in that price point. So what you're getting, Alex, is a trickle-down effect where the people who can't buy these like $2 million homes are buying the 1.5s, and the 1.5s are buying the 1s. It trickles down so that your price point is the most competitive because it is the most affordable to the widest range of people, and they're not building $300,000 homes. It just doesn't make sense.
And it's crazy that Vegas now, the median home price is like $488,000.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, I think what's more insane, it's going to be easier to score a good deal in a $1.5 to $2 million home than it is $500,000.
That's true.
Yeah. 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 I don't see a reason to buy in 2022, Alex. Like, I think this is one of the worst years you can buy. Like, there's just no doubt in my mind, real estate's, it's already going lower. Like, factually, like, I can't sell my house. I have to lower price. No one in that neighborhood can sell their houses. They have to lower price. If they keep it, their price, they're not moving.
Well, Jeremy,
yet.
What was the recent comp for your home? Because
I don't want to get into specifics, okay, but yeah. That whole neighborhood's not selling.
All right.
That whole neighborhood's not selling. So it's not like there was a direct problem with that. The whole thing, like I told you about the company, they had like two showings. Like there's no showings right now. Yeah. There's no buyers in the market right now.
Does it have a pool? It doesn't have a pool, right?
No.
Okay.
There's no buyers
in the market.
Talk about
square footage.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, no, even LA has been slower for showings.
Yeah.
Across the board for sale. Now, what I'm told, though, is under $2 million in Los Angeles is still really good.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but
under $2 million in Los Angeles, I mean that's like the
what's the median?
Average house.
Average is $2 million.
Well, I know. I mean exaggerating, but in areas that like from West LA to like West Hollywood,
right?
that's about what you're getting. Okay. I mean, that's the entry point is probably about 1.3 to 2.
What's
the
actual average in LA, the entire LA? Like a mil?
Probably about a million.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Which crazy. Sounds, you know, but that's including the areas like by the freeway and stuff like that, that, you know, aren't as desirable in terms of their location.
Would you live in LA again?
No.
No. Okay.
No, we went back there for a few days and it's odd. Sometimes when I'm here for like 3 months at a time, I kind of think, oh, it would be nice to, you know, go a weekend and just relax over there. I get there, I'm like, I just want to be back here.
That's funny.
For the first time, yeah. I mean, it's gotten so bad.
Wow. From what perspective?
Just traffic. Just everything. We got a Pokeball and...
A Pokeball?
Yeah, we got a Pokeball. Yeah, oh, so I measure things by like just
Pokemon
like
in my head.
I got a Pokeball. No, so we got this place here. What is it? A Poke-Poku? Mm-hmm. And you get like this big, large Pokeball for like $14.50. And it's large, so it has 4 scoops of fish.
2.5.
Well, in LA, we went to, and we didn't even go to a nice spot. Like this is like close to mid-city by like the 405 freeway. And like where the 10 intersects, we went to a Poke spot there and it was $20 for the medium. I didn't even get the large. $20 bucks. And it's the thing just it's horrible in comparison. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it's bad.
Wow.
Everything, gas prices are so high. The traffic.
Do you ever see yourself selling or renting that house down the road?
Yeah, the Santa Monica.
You'd consider.
I'd consider.
So you're
at
the point where you're at least in consideration.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The more time that goes by, the more I'm leaning in that direction. Wow. Okay. But right now, it doesn't make sense because I like just having a spot to go back to every few months, just for a weekend or something like that.
Sometimes I think about that with my Arizona house. Yeah. Not because I don't like Arizona, but because it's so scary.
Yeah.
Oh, snakes and scorpions.
Let me ask your opinion on this. So one of the things I want to do with my house is either rent it out, or I was thinking of having my parents sell their house, which is a townhouse.
Okay.
It's worth like between $300,000 to $400,000.
Okay.
And sell that home and move my parents into the single story, the one that I just purchased.
Yay.
And then using some of that money to remodel it, just bring it up to speed, and then whatever's left of that, let's say it's $300,000 or $250,000 or whatever it is, maybe I could use it towards just mortgages and just pay it for my parents.
Wow.
Because my parents are getting older, and I don't want to have them live in a two-story.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of doing that and I would trust them over like, you know, any other tenants.
I would probably rent your house and find them a great one-story closer to you. That's what I would do.
Yeah. Because I don't want to buy a house right now. At these rates.
Yeah.
These prices, sense. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. That's cool that you want to do that for your parents, though, and really help them out. Yeah. Like, you know, relationships are different for different people.
Yeah.
So that's powerful.
I don't know. I would wait until you get a little more money in the bank and have a little more, because that's a big commitment.
I was thinking that,
and
too.
And that's like basically you're committed $4,000 a month for a long time.
$5,000.
Yeah. You spend $5,000 a month for a long time. Yeah. I personally think a YouTube career that's doing well for 2 to 3 years is not long enough to be able to sustain that.
I agree.
If you had like $20 million net worth, I would say then it doesn't matter.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's too risky to lock yourself into that. And you don't want to be in a position ever where you say, mom, dad, like, I'm sorry, this is too much money. You got to move. Like you want to be in a position where you could comfortably say, don't worry about it.
That's a good point. And it's actually one of the reasons I want to do it is because it motivates me to keep going.
It's
one of the reasons where it's like it actually gives me a good reason.
Then I think you're better off just giving them the money directly. And then that way, it's not like you're locking yourself in, but should something, God forbid, happen, you're not obligated to like either.
What do you mean give them the money directly?
You're saying it's $5,000 a month?
Yes.
Instead of putting that in the house, give them the money directly.
I see.
And then that way, there's not this expectation of, well, you know, the market's not doing well, the channel's not doing well.
Right.
You gotta
You're
move.
Always gonna do well, Andre. Don't worry about that.
I'm always really cautious on stuff like this.
No, guys, same here.
Yeah.
You guys want to hear my my idea?
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'll do this, but obviously I like to throw ideas around in my head. My parents are living with my brother right now, and there's a house that is in the area where they kind of settled. And I considered buying it because it's like $180,000, and then renting it to my parents. Because they're on Social Security now, and I know they'll take care of the house. It's guaranteed income, but I don't know if I want to take on that risk, to be honest, especially before I buy a house. So
right,
what's the Yeah, I don't know. I personally, I wouldn't.
Yeah, but you could see why it's kind of appealing.
Yes, I would. I could.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just an idea I threw around my head. Probably not going to do it, but it was on the table for a little bit.
I'll probably rent it out first and then see where it goes from there.
Yeah. When is it going on the market?
Probably in 2-3 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, would you allow a subscriber to move in? What if he's like
a subscriber?
If they're qualified, him or her? Yeah. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I think you should tell them to reach out to you on Instagram if they want to rent your house out.
Oh gosh.
Why?
The income level that you'd have to get.
I think
that
you'd be surprised at who watches the channel.
That's more of my channel.
You'd be surprised, yeah.
Jeremy's like, my subscribers are rich.
Yeah.
Well, then why don't they buy your house, Jeremy?
Instagram.
Explain
story.
That, yeah.
I want 10% cut of Andre's. I've been so impressed by your channel, though, Andre. Oh, you know, what you've done in the space has just been amazing.
Thank you. I don't know how long it's going to last. But.
Oh, it's going to last a long time. It's been incredible to watch the whole journey of the finance. I don't know how many people actually know, and Graham and I, you and I reflect on this sometimes. I don't know how many people actually know, you know, like how the community kind of started and really like blossomed in like the big steps that were along the way. Cause I feel like a lot of people came across the finance space in the last few years.
Yeah.
They don't know like what it took to kind of get there.
Right. Jeremy was the seed that kind of just was like planted.
Yeah, Jeremy was one of the seeds. Minority Mindset, yeah. I think, was doing a little longer than you. Yeah. Beat the Bush was one of the first, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, from my perspective, I was looking at it, you know, when I started in 2016, and there was like no one having success at that
time. You
were
the stocks guy, though. I would say like the other guys are more like personal finance.
The first video I actually had that took off or got started getting views was how to negotiate a car deal.
Mm.
And I did that in the summer of 2016, and it started to get views, and my thumbnail's like this. And it goes into like how to negotiate a car deal. And it was interesting. Like, I think I was probably one of the first to make like a full-time income and kind of like open the door. And then Ryan Scribner, from what I remember, was a second person to go full-time YouTube. He, which I don't know how much he posts now, but he was an electrician. Mm-hmm. And left his job to also do YouTube full-time. And this was like, you couldn't even conceive of that back then. And then I think Graham was the person that was very important because he busted the door down. Yeah. Like, whereas maybe I hope opened the door, he busted it down and just like took it to crazy levels. Yeah. And then I also remember there was a guy in 2017 who started popping out of bushes. And I didn't like that guy because he used to use Graham's name all the time. What Graham Stephan isn't telling you and stuff like that. Oh. That was Mr. Kevin.
Yes.
And he came out with a different approach that no one had done that at that time. No one had really like used other people's names. Now it's very common in YouTube space where people plug my name, your name, and like, you know, what this person isn't telling you or whatever, right? But at that time, no one was really doing that. He was the first. And I got a little offended by that because I'm like, this isn't the way you do it, man. You build your own brand. Why are you using other people's names? Now it's so commonplace, you know? Yeah. But
his
first
thing
were
exposed videos in the very beginning.
Yeah.
They were all exposed. They were hit pieces. And there were some videos he posted and I was watching them thinking, oh man, this is,
I'm next.
This is, no. I never thought I'm next. Okay. I'm thinking like, it's bad. And I've openly told Kevin, dude, take the video down. Take it down. What he did is like, it's too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed it from the perspective of like, for entertainment and information, I thought like some of these videos were so good. Like I would watch them again today
because
they were that good.
Yeah.
But it's not, I just did not feel like it was the right way to, I don't know.
Didn't you get in trouble from somebody, like from one of the videos he did where he used you, didn't you get in trouble from your real estate company or something like that?
Yeah, that was the very beginning. He did a video titled What Graham Stephan Isn't Telling You.
Okay.
And I saw it as soon as he posted it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think anything of it. And I thought it was fine. I mean, I remember watching it and realizing like, wait a sec, because I talked to Kevin 2 months prior to that. He actually sent me a cold email. And he said, hey, you know, I'm also in real estate. My story is really similar to yours. And I called him.
Okay.
And I was barely doing YouTube at the time. And we probably talked for 20, 30 minutes.
Okay.
Instantly hit it off.
Mm.
And he said something like, you know, we should do a collab or something together.
Okay.
And I said, yeah, sure. You know, but my schedule was so busy. I mean, I just didn't know. And I kind of lost track of things. I forgot. And then that video comes out.
Wow.
And he sent an email, something like, hey, you know, you didn't get back over a collab. We weren't able to coordinate a collab or something. So I just did this video instead. And it was the what Graham Stephan isn't telling you. And what I wasn't telling you is that instead of putting 20% down on real estate, you could put 3% down. Right. And that's what I wasn't telling you. And I watched the whole video and I was a little taken aback by like he's popping out of bushes at a playground and like, but you know what? But I didn't have any issue with it. And I thought, you know, all things considered, it was a respectful video.
Yeah.
Fine. But the video started getting a lot of views. Mm. And like, pretty soon I saw it like 20,000 views, 50,000 views. And at that time, exposed videos were like ramping up.
Yeah.
And so this was seen, a lot of people were clicking on this as like, what's the exposed video?
Yep.
And it got like 100,000 views. And that's when my brokerage mentioned to me, when you type in my name on Google, the first thing that comes up is what Graham Stephan isn't telling you.
Oh.
And so when people would type in, you know, the Oppenheim Group, Graham Stephan, or some combination of that, that would be the video that comes up.
Mm.
And the concern was that clients who see that are not going to watch a video.
Yeah, like they'll just look at the title.
It's a 20-minute video. Yeah, it's a 20-minute video. They're just going to be like, well, he's not telling you. It's a bad look.
Yep, 100%.
And so so that was the issue that we had with that. But Kevin eventually changed the title.
I mean, we still get that to this day as YouTubers. It's like people just look at your title and automatically judge. Like, that's what your whole video is about. You could be a 20-minute video, and they're like, oh, you know, and it's like, watch the video, man.
Some of the titles are used tongue-in-cheek. So it's like the mother of all bubbles is... here. I mean, that's in reference to like a quote that somebody said, and we debunk that or mention it. So,
like, you said last week there wasn't a bubble. What do you mean? Now there's a bubble? And it's like, watch the video,
it's
man.
It's like people reading books by their titles. It's just like, I read the whole book.
Yeah. Lord of the Rings. Okay, got it. Harry Potter.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It's a book about the hairy guy named Potter.
Magic something. That's bad. Yeah.
But and then Andre, when you came out, you just had a whole new fresh take that was just beautiful.
Yeah, you know? No, the advantage I have over people like Kevin is, I always say, is that Kevin's much smarter than I am. So the way that he presents his videos is, it's very, I suppose, presumptuous in the language that he uses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's presumptuous in the sense that it makes sense if you are plugged into the market every day and you're watching it. But I think for the average person, it's like, what's the Fed? What are you talking about? Like, how are these variables connected to each other? And so I wanted to, I suppose, flip the script and instead of like building my YouTube channel for the sake of like people being like, this guy's so smart, being like, oh, cool, he breaks it down to average people. And that's kind of the way I took it.
No, 100%. And you know, it's interesting for your, you know, when you came out, Andre, and your channel started to take off, it's like you had a disadvantage and you had an advantage. Your disadvantage was, you know, obviously there were already channels in place, right? But at the same time, like, and it's an advantage because the space was already built. It wasn't like you were trying to grow into something that wasn't there. It was all right. Graham was already growing.
Right.
Like, there was a lot of creators, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, with Kevin, going back to like his success, you know, why can't other people duplicate his success? I think, one, he just outworks, I think, most people. Two, extensive knowledge on real estate. He's probably the most knowledgeable person on real estate. Like, he could tell you like why that door frame is not quite right. You should have used this wood, like crazy detail. Right. Like, I watched his Ben Mala video and he just completely decimates Ben Mala in this video from a few weeks ago. Just decimates him. Like, he's going through the house and he's like, what are you doing with it? Like, and he just owns him. I'm like, that's just
Kevin,
obliteration.
I watched that. Kevin was applying metrics that would work in his area in Ventura to a mansion in Florida where... just a different market. That's how I felt.
To be fair, Ben Mala didn't look like he was doing a very good job on that thing anyway.
Yeah, but when you look at ROI in a place like that, you're just not going to get the same. A lot of it, you may as well just leave as is.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, you gotta have that knowledge to bring it over to like convert, I guess you can say.
I've always poked fun of Kevin's remodeling approach. He's like, oh, this house is falling down. Glaze it. That's just
thing. I missed those are some of my favorite videos where he was buying the real estate and the titles are like, my house is falling off a cliff.
Yeah.
I loved I remember my favorite video is I found a dead body.
Oh my god, that was a video.
That was a video. Is I found a dead body. And it was a dead animal in the attic.
Oh my god.
I had no clue. I didn't
and then
know
there's another one. I think he took this video down or changed the title. His video is titled, I Left My Wife for a Model.
Oh.
All right. And he left his wife to go make an offer on a model home.
That's great.
These titles were so clever.
Oh, that's great.
Or I bought a house on quicksand, I believe was one of his titles.
Wow.
And it was like, I forget, but like they were so clever and so good.
People get very nostalgic about him in terms of like, get back to your old roots, your real estate days. That's what I used to enjoy.
But you know what the thing is? So. There's more viewers and the audience is so much bigger doing anything other than real estate. But the real estate audience is so
passionate
about it. And they'll watch anything real estate, but it's like 10% of the market as any other video.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So
like the stimulus checks, that was like everybody was clicking on those videos. Like, what's the update, man? $1,200 now? $2,000 check? Yeah. Remember that? It was like 2 to 3
he
updates a day.
He grew so much from those videos. Because he was first before CNN was able to make their videos.
Yeah. And you know what? Remember, he was number one on trending. He was the first finance creator ever to be number one on
was
trending.
Was it number one or number two?
Number one.
Wow.
Number one on trending for a stimulus update.
Wow.
But yeah, he as soon as it came out, I remember he would read through this thing and pump out a video, and it was a detailed video where he'd go over everything faster than any news outlet or anything else. He's the best source of news. I watched back then, I watched every single one of his videos, and he was posting 5 to 6 of them a day.
Oh my, that was insanity. 40 million views a month or something.
And people would always ask me, who watches those videos? Like, I watch every single one of them. It doesn't apply to me. I just find it so interesting. It's so entertaining.
Yeah.
Oh, my that's goodness.
Cool. So, by the way, before we end, I want you to guess how much my outfit costs.
Your outfit?
Yeah.
Ooh. What are you,
Can you tell
wearing?
Us the brands?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. I'm going to look at this. So I got,
what is that? Tom Ford?
Tom Ford.
Okay. Is that like real Tom Ford? I'm going to guess free.
Jason probably bought you that.
If I
had to guess,
that's free.
Yeah.
But if you would have paid for it, this is like a $500 shirt.
No
way.
I was
trying to find these.
How 500? Yeah. What is that made of?
Feel it. It's just like really, really, really soft material.
It's nice, but like I have shirts that feel like that. They're not 500. It's the brand, I suppose.
It's just a brand. Yeah.
That's crazy.
But I got a whole bunch of Tom Ford shirts.
Whoa.
A whole bunch of them.
That's cool. From Jason.
Yeah, it's actually Brett Oppenheim.
Was that just like he bought you it or it was like his old order?
No, so he gives me his own clothes.
That's cool.
So so he has not got a small closet, but you know, a smaller sized closet, and he seems to cycle through his wardrobe like once a year he'll buy new stuff. And I get everything that he doesn't wear anymore, and it fits me perfectly. And sometimes too, it's like if he bulks up a little bit, it doesn't fit him anymore, so he gives it to me and it fits me perfectly.
That's cool.
Yeah. So and a lot of them are tailored. And it just so happens that we're the same size and they fit me. Like they're a tailored fit.
Wow.
It's incredible.
That's why they say in life, it's about who you know. Who you know in life, man. That's the whole game.
You know what sucks is I don't have anyone else that I could pass on some of the clothes that he's passed on to me that I no longer wear.
Mm.
Enzo.
Really?
and like a year or two, I think.
In a few years. Yeah. If Jack were my size, just give him to Jack.
I
gotta find someone else to pass because I can't just throw. I would never throw them away.
Right. Just donate them.
I want to see someone wear them.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Put them to good use.
Put them to good use. Yeah. I want to see the
Give them to me, and then you could say I gave the shirt off my back to Andre.
Andre, you would fit.
I think I would fit.
You would fit some of the stuff that doesn't fit me.
Yeah, I think I would.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not that far off.
I have a whole bag of clothes I was going to give to Jack, but I'll let you look through
it. Yeah, let me know.
Cool. All right. So with that said, you guys, thank you so much for watching. Make sure to subscribe, by the way, if you haven't done that already. And also make sure to use FTXUS down below in the description with the code MMFTX. Sponsor our videos. They've been fantastic. With fees, by the way, that are much lower than the competition. So with that said, thank you so much. Subscribe. Until next time.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.